Interval Drinks is recorded remotely.
Interval Drinks is sponsored by Darwin Escapes.
Welcome to the Royal Shakespeare Company.
This is Interval Drinks, a podcast in which Royal Shakespeare Company resident artists talk to people who have inspired them over drinks.
I really recommend working at the RSC during a pandemic.
There's no audience that matches an audience of young people.
I mean, I literally left drama school thinking, this will never work out.
I'm trying to flatter you, but I'm probably insulting you at the same time here.
I don't want to be less soft. I want to be vulnerable.
I want to wander around with all my emotions terrifyingly close to the surface and then monetize that.
This is why I'm doing this. This is what I was born to do. And this is why I was born to do it.
I'll be catching up in the interval this week with the award-winning playwright Julia Jules Romero. Hello and welcome to Interval Drinks, the Royal Shakespeare Company podcast in which RSC artists like myself talk to other RSC artists, both past and present, who inspire us. My name is Kemi Bow-Jacobs and I'm an actor with the current RSC company, and I am playing the role of Hermione in Erica Wyman's upcoming production of The Winter's Tale. Today I'm thrilled to be joined by the award-winning playwright and journalist Juliet Jilks Romero. Juliet is the recipient of the Alfred Fagan Award for Best New Play in 2020, the Roland Rees Bursary in 2019, and the BBC World Service Alexander Onassis Research Bursary. Before becoming a full-time playwright, Juliet worked extensively as a journalist for the BBC, reporting from Ethiopia, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic. Her plays include Balad al-Sudan, Uppercut, and At the Gates of Gaza, which won Best Play at the Writers Guild of Great Britain Awards in 2009. Juliet's introduction to the RSC was with her play Day of the Living, performed at the Other Place as part of the RSC's Mischief Festival in 2018. Her most recent play, The Whip, written for the Royal Shakespeare Company, follows the political manoeuvrings behind the UK's 1833 Slavery Abolition Act and was performed at the Swan Theatre in 2020. Juliet, welcome to the show.
Hi, Kemi Bow. Thank you for having me.
Before we kick off, one of the questions that I really want to ask you is, when theatres finally reopen, which will be soon in whatever capacity, what will you be ordering at the bar?
I am rather partial to red wine, and my favourite at the moment is Montepulciano, which is a medium-bodied red wine from the central region of Italy, with notes of pepper, oregano and plums. It's rather tasty.
Well, I don't think I've tried it, but now I'm thinking, oh, actually, I might pop out and get some. It sounds delicious. I'd love to know, Juliet, do you remember what your first encounter with Shakespeare was? Where you were, how old you were, what you felt about it?
I think I was about 12 or 13. And we were studying Henry V for English. And or it might have been a bit later, it was for O-levels, which I don't think they have O-levels anymore. But I remember being really taken with his walk amongst his troops on the eve of battle, which kind of affected me emotionally, just wondering what that's like and knowing that actually you might not survive within the next 48 hours, and also knowing that battle at that time was a pretty gruesome affair. And also the speech that he gave to rouse his troops. I was very interested in the power of persuasion. And from studying that, it made me think about great speeches. I remember around that age listening to politicians and wondering who wrote their speeches. And at one point, I did want to be a speechwriter. I think it's quite a craft. And it made me think about Martin Luther King's speech, I Have a Dream. And I think that was, my goodness, what year was that? It was 1963, August 28th. the Great March on Washington. So the leap was, I guess, from Henry V to thinking about how we inspire and rally people.
It's amazing that the 12-year-old Juliet, applying that to the life, you know, applying a historical piece of drama to present day that you were in, I think that's wonderful. And tell me a little bit about your upbringing. Did you grow up in a household in which there was an appetite for arts and culture?
My mother was a school teacher. So when I was studying Shakespeare, there were always conversations around the dinner table, which allowed me to make those kind of leaps of imagination. I was born in East London, and we moved to Suffolk when I was about, I think I was 11, my brother was about 10, and we were the only black family in the village where we settled. My mum was the only black teacher in Suffolk County Council Education Authority. Dad was working for British Telecom as a research engineer. And I think because of the dislocation from this incredible West Indian community that we were raised in East London, my parents went to great lengths to take us at regular intervals to London, to the Commonwealth Institute, to museums. They took us to the National Theatre a lot. I remember seeing the Oresteia and Galileo. So we were very fortunate that culture played a major role in upbringing. And also my parents listened to BBC World Service a lot because that's what they listened to in the Caribbean. So I do think that my evolution of as a writer was very much inspired by my parents, who wanted my brother and I to understand the culture in which we were being, the British culture in which we were being raised, and also, you know, finding ourselves, you know, in a kind of like new community where we were the arrivals, we were the only ones, we were the black family. I know that they wanted us to be fluent, if you like, to really understand. And hats off to them. You know, they came in the 60s and that was where their interest was. But I think the fact that Mum taught actually had a big influence on that as well.
Wonderful. And it just strikes me that we've been in a situation for the past 12 months where we've been deprived of culture in a kind of a communal and a physical space. And I wonder what, clearly as a culture vulture, what you've missed about those experiences of going into a building or a space with other people and enjoying a piece of art or theatre.
What I really miss is that communal lived experience with total strangers. There is an excitement when you walk into an auditorium, you have your program, you've got your wine or your Coke or your rum and Coke, and you sit down next to complete strangers. But we're all there for the same reason. And that's to take a journey, to enjoy a story, to be surprised, to be shaken to our core, hopefully, because that's the kind of theatre that I like. But there is an unspoken understanding that we're going to share that space and we're going to behave and we're going to be challenged. And come the interval, we'll probably nod at each other and comment on what we've seen. And I think that's an extraordinary thing about humanity and about people, that we can do this. And it makes me sad when you think about conflict around the world, when, you know, we do know that we can gather like that in a cultural arena or crucible and enjoy story. Story is so powerful and it unites.
So tell me about your relationship with the RSC. So that as a child, your parents took you to the National Theatre. Did your relationship begin as an audience member or as a playwright? How did that journey start?
I think first it started in school because, you know, we learnt about Shakespeare. It was very much as a cultural interest through childhood. And then through being a commissioned writer, which was a huge deal because I remember when I told my family, I come from a huge diaspora, in the Caribbean, North America, Canada, and America. And when I told my relatives that I'd been commissioned for the RSC, I mean, wow, they were so impressed because it's a big deal to them. And again, culture, it's this thing about culture. And I think that sometimes people don't understand, particularly, the Caribbean's relationship to British culture. Shakespeare is a big deal. So everyone was really excited for me. And my first encounter was, number one, I got commissioned to write The Whip, but I was also commissioned to write Day of the Living. And I was freelancing at Sky News at the time and had been covering a story about Mexican training students, 43, who were abducted at gunpoint, brutalized, and never seen again through news. It was a very stunning story. You know, the news tends to be very picture-led, very sensationalist. So there's incredible headlines. You know, you've got pictures of these mothers desperate for their children. You know, 43 families are affected. And then, you know, after a week or two, the story disappears. It slides down the bulletin order, and then there tends to be very little follow-up. To be invited to tackle that subject was really important, and visionary, if you like. And to be able to invite a live audience to encounter that story and the themes of oppression, the drugs trade, what it's like to suffer in that kind of way, was more powerful, I think, than the offering of a news bulletin where you might get a minute 30 to write a report on something like that. And then, as I say, it tends to disappear. So that was the first play that I wrote for the RSC. It was at the other place, and people would come and be visibly moved. Some would weep. They all came to meet the company, chat with the creatives. They stayed in the bar for a long time afterwards. Many joined up with Amnesty International. And again, you know, I mean, I'm not doing down news. I was a journalist for many years, but there's something about being able to bring people into a space where we can breathe as one and experience a story like that from thousands of miles away and be powerfully affected by the lives of others in a way that I think the problem with news is that we become desensitized. You know, we see things, whether it's war, and I think about the Bosnian conflict or what's happening in Sierra Leone or even children being ripped from their parents' arms on the border with America. You know, we are desensitized. You put that on stage and ask people to sit there with you and take that journey and walk in other people's shoes, they will walk away transformed. I do remember one reviewer saying that it was obscene. And I was annoyed by it because I thought, yes, it is obscene. You know, we come to learn. And what happened to those students was an obscenity. But does that mean we don't put it on stage? No.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, Julia. It's so interesting to hear you speak with such clarity. You know, I can. You know, you're really your passion for the work. It's lovely to hear. But it leads me on to the question which you just touched on, which is your experience with the RSC. How has that changed you as a writer or informed the way that you work? What did you learn in a way of process or practice that changed, if anything?
So for Day of the Living, this was a devised play. And that was full on. I had never done devised work before. So, you know, we would have, we had a wonderful cast with two Mexican actors as well, which was great. And I remember actually we blessed the space. You know, we had a ceremony where we burned incense and asked the spirits of the disappeared students for permission to perform. And actually, we wanted to burn incense during the production, but that was going to be, you know, we had to inform the fire brigade. There's all kinds of, you know, interesting insights into how a building works and what you can and you cannot do. So, you know, there I was in a very live rehearsal situation, rewriting as we were getting the play on its feet, with a composer and a director and a designer and our company. And that was really exciting. And I think that I learned to respond in a very intuitive and intimate way. And then, of course, the other experience was with the Whip, and a wonderful company was drawn together by Kim Sykes, and they had such love for the play. We had a reading at the end of November before we went into rehearsals, which started, I think it was the 1st of December, which was like UN Anti-Slavery Day, which gave me goosebumps. It was, and I remember writing a blog for the rehearsal process, and so it was very personal being in that rehearsal space and to witness how the company responded to my work. And I think that all of these help you evolve as a writer. I like big themes. I love stories of political bite. So I tend to approach it very much as a journalist. I ran off to the House of Commons Library, got Hansard. I mean, I'm talking about thick books, literally from 1833 to 1834. And I did my research. The library staff were great. They got used to me. I was reading, you know, committee reports about, you know, will slaves be able to manage freedom? Will they know what freedom is? Will they know what money is? Will they know how to dress and feed themselves? I mean, extraordinary stuff I was reading there. But there comes a point where you have to literally throw the research over your shoulder, which is what, again, my evolution of as a writer. I'm very character driven. I learned that. That was a process. And you trust that you understand the research. Reading Hansard helped me with the tenor, the voice, the spoken English used in Parliament. I got a real rhythm for it. But at the end of the day, character was absolutely everything. I'm going to slightly digress in the sense that reading August Wilson, Tennessee Williams, these kinds of writers, you know, as a journalist and learning how you can take a political story but absolutely humanise and make it dramatic and powerfully dramatic through character were the real gifts that I learned. And we took the cast to the House of Commons. We took them for a tour. So they stood at the dispatch box. They took it in turns. And then we took them to, also there was a tour of the House of Lords. They stood in the lobby area where you wait to vote. And we all remember, you know, the cries of lock and unlock. And, you know, as people go in to vote, particularly during the Brexit debacle, and they really absorbed that. I think that was a really important visit, because the beautiful thing about The Swan and about the way that I wanted to write the play was that there were very private, intimate scenes and very public ones, you know, where there was parliamentary debate and kind of like political shenanigans and fighting going on. So I know that's a long answer, but that's how I've evolved, I think, from those two very different experiences.
There's a fearlessness to the subjects that you approach that one might be quite intimidated by the size and the scale of the things that you are compelled to write about. Where do you get that sense of size of ambition and lack of intimidation, you know, because you have been a playwright, you've been working for over a decade now as a writer, but these are still big, you know, big companies, big issues, multi-issue plays. Where does that fearlessness come from?
That's a really good question. And I guess I've never really processed it. I think that I am passionate about storytelling. I'm passionate about current affairs. I want to know about the world. And I've travelled a lot as a foreign affairs reporter, and I've met people, you know, in Ethiopia and Haiti. I've been to refugee camps. I remember presenting a programme called Britain Today for BBC World Service at a time when we were not allowed to broadcast the voices of Sinn Féin members. We had to get actors to do it because at the time, you know, there had been no peace process. So a lot of my ideas and feelings about the world, politics, democracy, truth, journalism are powered by that lived experience of having worked in newsrooms where I was constantly exposed to extraordinary people and journalists. I mean, at World Service at the time, there were over 40 language services. You've got in a lift to go to lunch, you'd hear Swahili, Hausa, Russian, German, and these filled me up. So when I started writing creatively, this is what drove me. This was my rocket fuel. What I found as a emerging writer, new writer, you know, not so much as a young writer, because in a sense I did come to it later than a lot of people. There was a tendency, obviously because there are risks with theatre, to put you into studio spaces, small spaces. And that kind of grated with me in the sense that I wanted to do big stories that necessarily wouldn't always fit into these spaces. I wanted to be given the platform or for people to have that trust so that I could use that platform to tell big stories, which kind of narrowed down into these intense characters through which to tell these stories. So I would say that I have big stories, but the characters are accessible, and that's really important. When I pitched The Whip to the RSC, I was invited to, I'd been invited on a day of provocation, and we'd spent a day talking about the Syrian conflict. We talked about everything, all the taboo subjects, that Brexit, nationalism, Trump, you name it. You know, I was always very interested in the morality or immorality of debt. I was very interested in what was going on in Greece. People couldn't afford to bury their dead because of the country was so indebted. And I came up with this play about debt, looking at people traffickers who'd been compensated. And I did my treatment on a size of A4 and I gave it to Pippa. And she read it and she said, "You and I both know that this is not going to fit into the other place," because I was invited to write a play for the other place. And I hadn't really processed that at the time. I just knew that this is what I wanted to present. And she commissioned it immediately for The Swan. So this comes down to opportunity. You know, I do have these big ideas, but that's because, and again, I kind of grew up listening to World Service radio, listening to my parents' stories about what it was like to come to Britain in the 60s as, you know, 20-year-olds finding their way. It's impossible not to be inspired and driven by big themes when you have that kind of upbringing, I think.
I'm aware that actually in 2005, Debbie Tucker Green was the first black female playwright to have her work staged in The Swan. And, you know, you've been writing for over a decade creatively, and we talk about access and opportunity. How much do you think the industry has changed or responded to the need and urgency that we should have a diversity of voices and perspectives on stage. Have you seen a shift, or do you feel as though there's still a lot of work to be done?
I think there's been a shift. So I took a sabbatical from the BBC and I went off to do an MA in writing for performance. I really needed that space. 24-hour news was driving me mad. I wanted to write and I wanted to learn. And I did, but I could honestly say that at the time, there wasn't the same commitment to diversity in theatre as you have now, that at least there is a conversation. The Alfred Fagan Award was going at the time, but not many people knew about it. People know about the Alfred Fagan Award now because so many Black writers have been given a platform or have come through the awards and, you know, garnered the attention and the interests of the arts industry and theatre makers. Then this is down to Alfred Fagan's legacy, who was an emerging writer and performer in the 80s. So I'm very proud of that link. But when I started, I'd never heard of Alfred Fagan. I'd never heard of August Wilson. There was an expectation that I wrote a certain kind of play. My first play was At the Gates of Gaza, which I started at Goldsmiths, and it was about soldiers, you know, the British West Indies Regiment. My annoyance was that Australian soldiers are recognised, New Zealand soldiers, they called them Anzacs. Everyone knows about their contribution. This was a world war. There were African regiments, there were West Indian regiments. A lot of West Indian soldiers, you know, were honoured with medals for their bravery. And they fought in what was, you know, Palestine at the time. And yet, when it came to the victory parades after armistice, they were not allowed to march.
It's just shocking to hear that, isn't it? You can't believe it.
It's shocking. So when I started to research and write these plays, I think a lot of people thought, well, why is she writing about men? Why is she writing about war? And I went to the Imperial War Museum and was reading diaries of men who'd passed away to be able to do this. That was the kind of chasm I had to leap over, if you like, to be able to get these stories to the fore, because there wasn't, I think, an awareness of Black writers with that kind of interest.
Just going back to The Whip, which closed early, as we know, as many theatres did due to COVID-19 and the pandemic, there's a wonderful line in the play that your character Mercy Price has, which it's linked to what you've just said about this narrowing of expectation that perhaps you've experienced as a Black female playwright that perhaps white cisgendered men don't experience. They seem to have be able to write about anything and from any perspective. She has a line which is, I've actually written it down. I'm not reciting it. I've learned to navigate myself in all manner of environments. Unfortunately, different rooms require different versions of me. And I can relate to that, what she's just said. So I suppose, again, that question is as your work as both a playwright and a journalist, I suppose a contemporary name for that would be code switching. Do you feel as though that you have to change yourself to adapt to different environments, but also, as you said then, there is a sense that, well, you should be writing about Black issues.
Yes, and it's funny. It is the line that a lot of women talk to me about, and, you know, post-play, you know, I'm in the bar, and because people really feel it, and it's a lived experience, you know. what I've learned from that is that I don't tend to code switch anymore. When I was younger, I did, to fit in. When I joined the BBC and was the only black, you know, journalist in the, a particular television newsroom, you know, and you wear a certain mask, you know, what I used to call BBC face. And then as I got more confidence, I would get more feisty about the editorial judgments and stories that I wanted to see on air, which meant led to greater editorial fights. But that, again, that was a process, and you're constantly code switching, and Mercy has to do this. And I love that about Mercy, you know, the fact that, you know, she could go to a tavern, a public space, and play the runaway slave. But what people don't realise about slaves, like, or runaway slaves like Frederick Douglass and Mary Prince, they educated themselves. They could speak English better than the English. They were articulate. They had to be, because they weren't seen as human. So they had to be more human and better at it than the people who looked down on them or saw them as in some way disabled because of the colour of their skin. So when Mercy is in that room with Boyd, he's shocked, you know, because the woman he saw in the public meeting is not the woman who presents herself at his house, and she's able, she jousts with him. She jousts with him intellectually, and I loved writing that scene, and he's constantly taken aback. And it is a code switching, and I think that we do it for survival. But now, you know, I feel, you know, do we have to do that? And I look at people like Ava DuVernay, you know, the people that I really admire, Toni Morrison, you know, these creatives who, to find your authentic voice, I think there comes a point where you say, nah, take it or leave it.
Yeah, there's no compromise, is there?
This is who I am.
No. And just, you mentioned two characters there, Frederick Douglass and Mary Prince, who I believe characters in The Whip are loosely based on or inspired by. For people that haven't seen, that didn't get to see the play, how do you write so authentically the English of the time? How did you meet that challenge? Did you work with someone on that, or did you find it just came naturally once you got to know the characters?
I'm really smiling because I regard that question as a huge compliment. As a writer, you know, you have to channel. And if I'm writing about 1833, I have to be able to bring that to a kind of like live theatrical experience where people believe that they are in that time. And the way that I achieved it was I read so much. Being in the House of Commons library, reading Hansard, reading the English of the time, and reading a lot around the subject helped me. I love music. To me, writing is like, it's like listening to a piece of music. I was a very poor sight reader, but I could play anything by ear, so I would cheat. I would get my music teacher to hum a tune to me, and I'm away. But, you know, I found sight reading as a little bit more effort. But once I hear a character, by osmosis in a way, I get a feeling for their kind of like emotional cadence and how they speak. So I guess it came naturally after having completely immersed myself in the time. And that's what I love about writing, because it gives me an opportunity to visit different worlds. I love to recreate a world and then drop an audience in it, no holds barred. So they've got to play catch up. And I think that's what people love. I think that those are the kinds of plays that I want to see. You know, I've written a play, Raising Cain. It's half in Spanish, you know. But that's not a barrier to understanding, particularly if you're working with metaphor. So it is about channeling what you hear and what you learn the fights in Parliament over this bill, the language used really helped me.
Yeah, that language was so rich, and it, you did it. You immediately felt as though you were in that world, and I really enjoyed it. So, Julie, you did train and work as a journalist very successfully. At what stage in your career did you think, oh, I'm going to try creative writing? And why theatre as well? Why not go and write novels? What was it about the stage that you felt both suited and satisfied that your voice?
Well, I think that I started writing creatively as a child. I mean, I read voraciously, and my parents were constantly, they would just buy books and leave them around for my brother and I to play with, draw all over until we started reading them. And I remember writing a kind of like musical version of Alice in Wonderland. I was about 9 or 10, but you know, you don't have it. You don't kind of limit yourself. You know, it's up in my parents' attic. It sounds grand. I don't know if this was any good.
I'm thinking, when are we going to see that?
but to me, I just remember lazy Sunday afternoons and just playing, having read it, just playing around. And but I was always fascinated by the power of TV news. I was fascinated by these foreign correspondents who would go to these incredible countries and meet people and having that window into the lives of others who had a very different cultural reality and social reality to my own. And so I went down this kind of documentary current affairs life. I made a lot of programs in countries like Ethiopia and Haiti. And they all have form and structure to me, like theatre in many ways. But there came a point, there was a definite point where 24-hour news was driving me crazy. I just felt it was terribly reactionary. And I mean, I remember after 9/11, we were rehearsing for the War on Terror, designing graphics, getting ready like boxing promoters. And I remember thinking, you know, not a bullet has been fired yet, and we're preparing our audience for war. And I decided, it was 24-hour news is exhausting. I actually worked 9/11, and I remember arriving about 2 o'clock for my shift. That was about the time that the first plane hit. I walked into the gallery, put down my handbag. I remember wanting to go for a pee and not remembering for 12 hours later because of the cascade of events. I mean, it was unbelievable, but it was exhausting. And I decided to take a year out. I needed to take, and just to process everything that I'd experienced, my what did I want? You know, where was Juliet's head at? And so I was fortunate enough to get onto the MA writing for performance, but it wasn't what I wanted to do initially. I wanted to do film, but I didn't get accepted onto a film course. You know, what I submitted, I hadn't actually completed a screenplay. And I think what I submitted read more like poetry. But Goldsmiths took me on. And it was the best thing. So I had some friends actually who went to LA to do screenwriting. I was a little bit envious. They invited me out. But there were so many people sitting in cafes writing screenplays. And, you know, I was at Goldsmiths and, you know, in London. And, like, in rehearsal, they'd bring in a director and actors and they would read my work. And that this was not happening to my friends in LA. And the first time I heard my work read by actors, actually, it kind of moved me to tears, laughter. I couldn't believe it. And I remember there was one scene from At the Gates of Glass and the actors were laughing. I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, is there something wrong with what I've done? But they said that they're really enjoying the characters. And I learned and I was able to write more because I was, you know, riffing off of the emotional reaction from the actors. So that I've almost forgotten your question. But that was, I think, the kind of the journey from childhood journalism to wanting a more creative space to process what I'd experienced. As I said, news is very reactionary. The advent of 24-hour news has, and now social media has really changed that game. Everything, you know, I mean, you only have to look at what happened, you know, at Capitol Hill, because we had a president who refused to concede an election, was telling people to go out and fight, spreading on social media, unchecked on television news bulletins, you know, news, you know, things, lies and fake news being carried unfettered. You know, these things truly trouble me.
Yes, that leads me on to my next question, actually, Juliet, which... it's a quote, you probably will be aware of it, and it always stays, I think it's a wonderful quote from Picasso, who very famously says that, and I paraphrase slightly, that art is the lie that makes us realise the truth. And in a post-truth era, if you like, do you think there is more space and opportunity for you to speak the truth on stage through your work as a playwright than perhaps there was through your work as a journalist or for journalists today?
When I'm commissioned to write a play, I have the license to tell the story as I would like to see it, what my vision is for it. And if the themes I'm looking at are truth, then it's down to me to extrapolate and humanise that. And that's a different kind of freedom. So... you know, I really do believe that theatres, stage, political theatre can attack these subjects, particularly because an audience are coming for that. They know what they're coming for. There's a quote by an Indonesian author and journalist that I often think about, and it's, when journalism is silenced, literature must speak, because while journalism speaks with facts, literature speaks with truth.
Wow, that's wonderful.
And I think that the whip was that, you know, I could speak with a truth. We did not know that people traffickers, slave owners, had been compensated to the tune of billions in modern day money. The government borrowed a loan to pay them, and that was finished in 2015 by every working man and woman in this country, including people like myself who are descended from slavery. That's not taught in schools. No one knew about this.
No. Shock.
So theatre gave me the opportunity, you know, to do this, and it could do this in a newsroom as well, but it's a different process.
Yeah, and going back to what you were saying earlier as well, is that the legacy and the residue of the work that you see on stage, journalism kind of pales in comparison, as you said, that, you know, news is within, as we have 24-hour news, the cycle of news is so fast, and people have become very desensitized to what they view. And very mistrustful as well of, of what they see.
Which, so don't get me wrong, I mean, I think journalism is powerfully important, you know, one of the most inspiring journalists that, you know, I ever came across is Mary Colvin, who died for what she believed, and she would stay in war zones long after, you know, most people had kind of like run for safety. But, you know, we need journalism, and it's under assault. The first thing that authoritarian leaders will do is undermine the press, so that the public doesn't know, you know, what is truth and what is what isn't. And I find this profoundly worrying. So I think that journalism needs to be preserved. It's an important function of democracy. Mm-hmm. We need it. I think in tandem, theatre is also a fantastic crucible for truth. And if this is happening to journalism, and if democracy is under attack, then the place to debate this and really examine what's happening in our world is often the stage.
Because culture and creativity is often about independent thought, isn't it? And new ways of thinking. I just want to talk about something, a quote that I read from your website, Julia, and I thought it was lovely. My subject matter is largely political and concerned with the handprint of history on the present moment. And also, you quote that you said, untold stories, your passion is untold stories and inconvenient political truths. And again, it strikes me that much of your work is about giving a voice to those who have been silenced or even erased from history. What do you think, given all that you've said about the work that attracts you and that you are ambitious to create, what do you think society loses when we fail to get a diversity of perspectives and voices contributing to the construction of history for today and for future generations?
Well, we get what we're seeing now. Polarisation, ignorance and violence. There was a historian who was asked, I think it was the National Trust, to research links to the slave trade. And she was inundated with abuse and vitriol for her role in simply telling the history of this country. That's insane. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't cherry pick our history. And this is why, so for the whip, a lot of people before it opened kind of dismissed it. Oh, and the slave play. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I smiled to myself because I thought they're going to learn a lot more than slavery.
Yeah.
Because it's British history. This was 1833. Mm. In 1831, there had been riots by working men for the right to vote in Bristol. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who are now looked on as heroes of democracy. You know, last spring we saw people protesting against statues that venerated people traffickers. Mm. And these pictures were on the news. And of course, the public are horrified. Who are these people? What are they doing? But they don't know that in Bristol, for many years, for decades, there were, you know, the parts of the community were questioning this. Edward Colston made a lot of money through the slave trade. A lot of slaves died in the hulls of his boats. That's in like 10% attrition rate on his boats alone. Mm. He used the money to build almshouses, schools, which benefited English people, white people, at the expense and death of children, men and women. This needs to be understood. Now, if people don't understand how this country was made rich, they don't understand that capitalism grew and was fueled by the greatest movement of trafficked people in history. This is how nations got rich. For people to be offended by that subject matter is wrong. And this is where you get people, you know, taking great offense, talking about free, it's our freedom of speech to denounce these things. We're not interested. And that worries me, because unless people have an understanding of history, unless they understand that the working class in this country, particularly children, died in cotton mills. I read reports about the abuse of children in cotton mills that would make you weep. And people don't know this. Mm-hmm. People don't know that after the First World War, by June 1919, black war veterans were being attacked in the streets and riots erupted in Liverpool, Cardiff, Glasgow. A lot of them had to flee to the shores. They were living on the shores. And these riots were so fierce because the country was bankrupt. There wasn't work. It was a tinderbox. You've got men returned from war, trained in the art of warfare, fighting. It was proposed that the black community of this country should be interned in military camps and on naval ships off the coast and then deported. These are men and women who either fought in the First World War, the men, or women, and I'm talking about black women who came from the Caribbean to work in munitions factories or at Tate and Lyle, you know, sugar and stuff like that in Liverpool. And yet that history is not known. And when you want to discuss these things, people get offended because, number one, they're like, what are you talking about? They don't know. They've never heard of it. I wrote a radio play about it, One Hot Summer. And the response was good, actually. It was powerful. You know, people just didn't know. And I think that unless we know our history, there's going to be more trouble. And it saddens me greatly. And that's why I think that writers do have a kind of duty to occupy that space and make sure that there are things that should never be forgotten.
Hearing you speak about history and the characters that you've encountered as you've reached back into the past to draw something into the present that will speak to people and educate people about history, when you meet those characters that you've written about or have been inspired about, which of those characters has had the greatest impact on you that has perhaps stayed with you? Because they must become like friends, I imagine.
Oh, they do. They do. I mean, and as a writer, and it's almost like a schizophrenic existence. You know, because you have to, for the drama to be powerful, you must know what that arc is, what their needs and wants are at any given moment, in any scene, any point of dialogue, because a scene is about transformation. And if you're juggling these characters and they're, you know, learning from each other, they're fighting with each other, you've got to know all of this intimately. My goodness, are you asking me if I have a favourite?
I am. I'm not going to press you on it, but if, yeah.
I love them all. Obviously, you know, Mercy and Horatia in The Whip, two women who are really important to me, and which is why it ends, you know, with them. And I remember when it was Richard Clothier had come for the audition, he did say, this is a play about women. And that was really humbling that he understood that, because that's a sucker punch of The Whip, and it's called The Whip. Everyone thinks that this is going to be a kind of very masculine play about politics. And it is, but it's the women who drive a lot of the decision-making and the drama. And a lot of people have said, what happens next with Horatia and Mercy? They want to know, because, again, this is part of history. A lot of women, a lot of English women, a lot of white working class English women were appalled by slavery and drove the petitions. Wilberforce was against the involvement of women in the abolition movement originally. And these women would send these petitions. We saw the petition bag at the back of the speaker's chair when we visited the House of Commons. And I think that to be able to bring life to women like this is incredibly important. And to a character like Mercy, who is inspired by Mercy Prince, who ran away and fought for abolition. So those two make me smile, and I get asked about them a lot. I love Lord Hyde Villiers. I often put my strongest arguments in the mouths of the characters who I would disagree with the most, because everything that he's saying makes sense, particularly from his perspective in 1833. He's a man of his time. And you know, oh, I love them all. My goodness. I find it hard. I just think, yeah, just, and that's the magic. That's the magic of being a writer, to create characters who you feel as if they're living, they occupy a space.
Given the last 12 months and the events that we've seen unfolding in this country and globally, what do you think the responsibility is of playwrights to and the theatre world? What should change, and what would you like to see being staged or you know, brought into those spaces?
There's a quote by Albert Camus that I really love. The purpose of a writer is to keep civilization from destroying itself.
My goodness, that's a big responsibility.
And I used to read this quote and think, was he serious? This is quite a statement. And I have to say that now, after all we have been through, there's so much truth to this sentiment, this quote, because what we really need to look at now is our planet, our environment, resources, and how we, as you know, as humanity, preserve and share what we have. And I think that particularly young writers who are emerging from underneath this global pandemic will be very concerned with our environment and our planet, how politics, how the disruption of democracy affects our commitment to climate change, concerns about how nationalism perhaps holds us back from coming together to solve socio-political problems together. I'm very keen. I do a lot of workshops with young people now, and you know, they've had a rough time of it. But I say to them, you know, your confidence and your hunger to document what we've experienced will be very important for future generations to come. It's not like we haven't been here before at this particular point before. We have an opportunity to make a difference.
I love that. We have an opportunity to make a difference. And a very light question for you, Juliet. You have this wonderful relationship with the RSC, and clearly you have a passion for historical drama, so therefore Shakespeare. If you could meet one of the characters in one of Shakespeare's many plays at the bar for an interval drink, who would that person be, and why would you like to bump into them there?
Okay, so I'm not a Shakespeare aficionado, but I have to say I'm quite partial to Viola from in Twelfth Night, and her need for disguise, code switching, and for survival.
Mm.
I wouldn't mind having a conversation with her, because I see space for her in my kind of work. I think that her existence kind of emphasizes the vulnerability of women venturing outside of the home. And I think about the vulnerability of women, as we've seen recently, you know, being safe. And having to disguise themselves, and what happens when they're not safe. It's interesting that Shakespeare kind of played with these issues.
Mm, absolutely, yeah. That's a very profound point. You're right, now that idea that we have to disguise, conceal, avoid, moderate in public spaces. Juliet Jilks-Romero, thank you so very much for speaking to us today. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. You have a wealth of knowledge, and I feel inspired just having spent this with you. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Kemi Beaux, for having me. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And I'm imagining my glass of Montepulciano as well. So it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Join us next week on Interval Drinks, where Avita Jay will be sharing a drink with the actor Adjoa Ando. Remember, you can catch your favourite episodes again on the Royal Shakespeare Company website.
Interval Drinks is sponsored by Darwin Escapes.